Hi, I'm John Weber. My guest today is Grammy Award-winning composer, arranger, and pianist Lawrence Hobgood. Although best known for playing with jazz vocalist Kurt Elling, critics agree that Lawrence Hobgood is far more than a sideman. He's been called the single most underrated and ridiculously talented U.S. jazz musician of his generation. And All About Jazz describes him as one of the finest jazz pianists out there, period. I can't wait to hear him play. Lawrence Hobgood, welcome to Piano Jazz.
John Weber, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
What a journey, man. I have had the pleasure of watching you evolve, and I vicariously enjoyed watching your triumphs over the years, and just how did we get here, man?
Oh, man. You know, well, first of all, the feeling is mutual, John, and it's been an honor to know you these almost three decades now, and man, how did we get here? I don't know.
I think we must have met at the Green Mill in Chicago, where we both lived about 20 years.
Yep.
Our second domicile.
I believe we did meet at the Mill, actually.
It is the ultimate jazz hang, I must say, the Mill.
Yes.
You moved to Chicago in 88 and immediately rose up the ranks to the top echelon of musicians in town. I remember you were playing with Paul Wertico and
Ed Peterson.
And all at the Green Mill. And I heard you play, and I remember being intimidated and at the same time inspired beyond belief, thinking that watching Lawrence Hobgood play what he does, I thought, man, this is pianistically possible. So I would feel kind of dumb and kind of smart watching you do your thing.
Well, there's plenty of people that have felt that listening to you, John, so there's lots of room.
I am eager to hear you play something. Would you like to do a solo number?
Sure. We can start that way.
Yeah. What haven't I heard you do yet?
Well, I thought I'd play a newer composition of mine, which is dedicated to Keith Jarrett, and it's called One Version of Happiness.
Wow. I would love to hear you play.
All right. Thank you.
Well, that was certainly one version of happiness that I love.
Thank you very much, John.
Just truly beautiful. And I would imagine that when you were a kid taking piano lessons, it was probably your proclivity to stray from the written works of your Beethoven and Bach and
yes, Chopin. I would frequently depart from the text.
Oh, to the horror or delight of your teachers?
Oh, I was more the former. I like to hope that there might have been a smattering of the latter that they kept secret because they weren't going to let me see that.
But, you know, every great composer went through that. I'm sure that when Bach was practicing his Buxtehude on the organ, he thought, two voices? Why not five? Jeez, what's the matter with this guy? So it's always evolving. It's always changing. And thank God there are guys like you who are able to assimilate stuff from all over the place. I mean, your source material, you've always managed to take music from, I mean, I can remember in the 80s and 90s you being just as excited about the new Keith Jarrett record as you would be about the new Peter Gabriel record.
Mm-hmm.
And your sort of big tent approach of inclusion has it helped? Has it inspired your creative process?
Very much so. The influence of wide-ranging ideas is... music is to some extent an oral visualization, if you can combine those two sensory illusions.
Of course.
I think it's possible to realize musically almost any sort of thing that you encounter.
I know you read a lot. You're extremely well-spoken, and you must encounter in literature as well some inspiration for your music.
Absolutely. Very frequently. We were bantering when we were getting ready to start our session here, and we both knew the old joke about the sculptor who sculpts ultra, ultra exacting images of whoever is the subject. And somebody finally asked him what the secret was, and he just said, well, you know, if I'm doing a bust of John there, I just start with this big slab of marble and chip away everything that doesn't look like John.
There you are. There you are.
So to me, realizing these things is very much sort of coming from that direction. You feel or hear the beginning of something, and then it's mostly just a question of letting that realize itself and getting all the other stuff out of the way, you know. Yeah. A case in point would be a tune I wrote not too long ago called Shirakumo no Michi.
Huh.
That's Japanese, means white cloud way. And that was based on a book I read called The Way of the White Clouds.
Oh, yeah.
About a German-born gentleman who became a Tibetan Lama, Anarika Govinda, I think was his Tibetan his Buddhist name. It was just a fascinating, inspiring story about a guy who just gives himself over to a spiritual life. And so that just prompted this tune.
You just read the book and sat down to your piano and out came Shirakumo no Michi.
That is correct.
Oh, wow. I want to hear you play it.
All right. Thank you.
Lawrence Hobgood, the composer, pianist. Unbelievable, Lawrence.
Thank you, John.
Wow. Now, when you arrange or compose something like that, this sort of one-man orchestra, do you need to hear it immediately played by your musical associates right away, or can you sit on 10 tunes like that in a folder and then take them when you have an album's worth?
Well, now, it's funny that without meaning to, you've happened on my favorite Duke Ellington quote. He was being interviewed and was addressing the issue of not understanding how classical composers, might spend 6 months or a year writing a piece and then might have to wait another 6 months or another year before they get to hear it played. And he said he couldn't do that. And the quote is, "That is why I keep these very expensive gentlemen with me to gratify that desire."
That's it.
Anytime you can hear your new music as soon as possible, that's always best.
Wow. I love the waltz feel. You do that like really nobody else I know. You have this driving, full, it sounds like you got 20 fingers. I mean, it's a cliche, but just, I don't. Have you ever started out a tune? Has a tune ever evolved out of just a groove? Have you ever just thought of some four-bar passage of, oh, that's, God, that's good enough to be a whole tune? And then has that ever evolved into something like what you just did?
Yeah. I think that the groove consciousness is crucial. So one of the pieces I might play today started just as the idea of a real down-home bluesy groove. One of my... I like to mix paints, you know?
Yeah.
And it is not infrequent to have some larger idea come out of a groove consciousness, just as you're asking.
Well, you have plenty of harmonic sophistication, that is for sure. And I think that combined with a down-home groove would probably be a fabulous tune. What are you thinking about playing?
It's my paean to the Midwest. It's called Sweet Moraine.
Oh, as opposed to?
Well, of course, the classic Sweet Lorraine is a famous standard, but I lived for over 30 years in a part of the world that I'm not from, which is central Illinois. And it's funny, but it's grown on me. Both sides of my family are from mountain people, and I like elevation. I like mountains. And so it's kind of ironic that I spent some significant portion of my life on the flat. And anybody who has not been to Central Illinois, it doesn't get flatter than
flat
that.
Flat as a pancake.
It does not get flatter than that. And so they have this, I used to make fun of it, because a moraine is a geological formation is left from the Ice Age, and they're just these very gentle, you wouldn't even call it a hump, really. And, of course, some of them are miles long. It's just a little place, basically, where it isn't totally flat. And they make a big deal about that. There's even a place in Champaign County called High Point, and that anybody would call this High Point is really ridiculous. But it has its own beauty, like most places on the planet, and it's grown on me over the years. And I also have developed great affection for many, many of my good friends back home.
Well, you could certainly provide me with a high point by playing Sweet Moraine.
All right, I will.
I'd love it. Thank you. man, Lawrence, that you just swung so hard.
Oh,
that
man.
Swings so hard.
Well, you know, 18 years in Chicago.
I am envious of you.
Well, man, you're too kind.
Sweet Marine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's more coming up with composer-pianist Lawrence Hobgood. Our program is made possible in part by NPR and the National Endowment for the Arts, Artworks. I'm John Weber, and this is Piano Jazz from NPR Music. You know, Lawrence, as incredible as your solo playing is, as much as I love it, you have done incredible duos with bassist Charlie Hayden, with obviously vocalist Kurt Elling, and with even poet laureate Robert Pinsky, where you spontaneously orchestrate his poetry. What is it about working with another person that brings something out in you?
Well, you know, the old aphorism, two heads are better than one. It says it all. If you can just swallow your, it's not necessarily ego, but just your identity. If you can elasticize your identity enough to incorporate the ideas of someone else, and there's a certain chemistry to it. It is very helpful not to be collaborating with someone who thinks like you do, because you want to have different ideas. You want to bring different strengths to the table. But yeah. In my experience, that's usually not that hard, finding somebody that has different strengths from yours. And if you can agree on a vision, if you can agree on a common goal, which broadly stated would be to make something really good happen.
Well, every time I've played a duet with you, we sat down and played either four hands on one piano or played two different pianos in some settings. Something amazing always happens, because typically, I'm told that two piano players on a gig is one too many, but I disagree. I happen to think that when two heads get together and start playing a duet, and there are two of us here, so perhaps we should play a duet.
I think we should.
Maybe one of your tunes.
Okay. Which one would you like to do?
There was a tune on State of the Union, your second trio album with Brian Torf and Paul Wertico, mm-hmm. on which you did an original tune, another great waltz called Beyond Words.
Yeah.
Let's do it, man. I want to do it.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, man.
Glorious, Lawrence.
Oh, I love it.
What a beautiful song, man.
I love it when some other great pianist plays one of my tunes better than I can. That's always...
Now, is it a song? Have you actually added words to it? Is it a tune or a song? We have
no one's ever written words to that. That does not mean that it's beyond words. I don't necessarily.
Beyond words, yeah.
Maybe I don't necessarily think words. It is. Well, you know, I was in love. What are you going to do?
I mean, do you ever accidentally or maybe not so accidentally write lyrics to your music? Because you obviously read a lot and you probably read a lot of poetry. Who knows?
I've been writing more lyrics, actually, believe it or not.
I think that's way cool. You're a songwriter.
Well, I am blessed to collaborate with one of the funkiest wordsmiths who has trod the planet, Mr. Kurt Elling. And so that in and of itself, and rightfully so, has kept my lyric writing sort of on the back burner. People used to ask me if I wrote lyrics as well. And I said, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with just a good Chevy Impala. But, man... when you got a Ferrari sitting in the garage, you're probably going to not even deal with the Impala. And that's how I feel about Kurt's lyric writing. But but I have been moved by the muse, you know. So when that happens, you write it down.
You're moved by a lot of muses. In fact, I notice in your song titles a very strong spiritual component, Prayer for the Enemy, Prayer for Mr. Davis, Revival, Spirits Rejoice, Sanctuary. Have you always found a spiritual musical connection in your performing and composing? And where does it come from?
Wow. Yes. And to just sort of sum up, I think there's a lot of people, maybe especially in the arts, but a lot of people who feel deeply that there is something profoundly other that is... really beyond our mortal ability to define. The cliche, I suppose, has become spiritual but not religious.
Yeah.
It's a phrase I'm not that fond of myself. And I'm not trying to diss anybody's thing here, but actually what I'm trying to do is just say that I think that these things are not simple.
Yeah.
I think these things are deep and very, very complex. And so my own personal thing is to believe deeply in something that not only we're not sure what it is, but my instinct is we're not really supposed to know.
Yeah.
That does come out in the music, especially if the music is a reaction, a response to a special situation or perhaps a special place.
Yeah. Lawrence, you do a tune called Cumberland, which taps into that whole spiritual musical connection that we've just been discussing. And why is it called Cumberland?
Well, we have family roots, actually both my mom's and dad's side, but principally my mom's in terms of my experience of it, in the Cumberland Mountains, southeastern Kentucky. Sort of famous spot, Cumberland Gap, mm-hmm. Which is, I've gone camping there more than a few times. Very, very beautiful place where there is a geological anomaly of sorts in that there is a gap where there should not be one according to the rules of geology. And it is famous for being the place where the westward migration really a big part of it happened there. Daniel Boone led the settlers after having blazed the Wilderness Road, and I gather that it was something of a conundrum. How are we going to get out of these mountains? And then they found this spot, and that's Cumberland Gap. It's at the intersection of, I believe, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia.
Yeah.
And because I've had some wonderful camping trips down there.
I would love to hear you play Cumberland.
All right.
That was glorious, man. A very prayerful sort of vibe.
Oh, thank you.
I want to change gears a little bit and talk about somebody who had a beautiful quote about you, and that's Dave Brubeck, who said, "Lawrence Hobgood is one of the most incredible pianists I've ever heard." I don't think he hands out compliments like that to everybody, so or anybody but you, really. So, I mean, tell me about your association with the great Dave Brubeck.
Oh, man. Well, talk about a blessing. For the sake of brevity, I will tell you that the very first time we ever met, we were playing at a little outdoor festival near his home, and he came. And he came back, and we all shook hands and everything like that. And we sat down, and I swear the very first thing was he looks at me, and he says, "Now, Lawrence, what's the tune on the record? It's a Comden Green tune." And I said, "You mean Never Neverland?" And he goes, yeah, that's the one. Now, what exactly are you doing with the time on that arrangement?"
6/8 or something.
And I'm sitting there just going, Dave Brubeck is asking me what I'm doing with the time.
Yeah, just
unbelievable. So I looked at him and I said, "Well, Dave, the voice and the piano are in 9/8, while the drums are in 6/8, and when the two pairs meet up, right at the moment that they meet up on a downbeat of a phrase, there's a metric modulation, quarter note equals dotted quarter into a walking 5."
And he knew exactly what this
and
meant.
And he just goes, that's it, I knew it was something like that.
Wow.
It was one of my great pinch me moments of all time.
And the fact that he'd analyzed your record and listened to it and had a question for you about it.
Yeah, oh, a complete surprise to me. I mean, we were brand new at that point, and this is not in any way disparaging to Kurt, but just the way the business works, if you're someone that was in my position, you don't even know if anybody's going to be aware of who you are, you know? I mean, Kurt's the guy with his name on the record, so... That question came out, and I was like, wow, you know, Dave Brubeck's asking me a question. Dave Brubeck is asking me this question, and it's about odd time signatures. Wow, who knew?
Well, you had made quite a splash. I mean, you've been nominated for a Grammy for every single record you've done with Kurt, which is no small feat either. But he knew exactly who you were. He knew, and he knew you were somebody to watch, and he was right.
Wow, that's very nice, and it was an honor, believe me, to get to know him a little bit.
Now we should honor Dave by playing one of his tunes. What do you think?
I would love that. You know, in your own sweet way.
How about a duet? What do you think? Another Fender Rhodes piano duet?
I think it's great.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, Dave would have been mighty proud of you on that one, man.
Oh, man.
What a blast to play his music. What a great blueprint that is for improvisation, isn't it?
You know that we had the supreme pleasure of visiting him in his home. And probably the main thing in that experience that stood out to me was that he had music writing stations all over his house and property. Converted closets, desk out in the fishing shack. Man could not stand to be more than 25 feet from manuscript paper in case he got an idea.
Obviously.
And I came away from that experience going, man, this guy is, he's the real deal, 100%.
Without
creative
a doubt.
Artist, 24/7. Just what a gentleman and what a wonderful addition to the iconosphere.
He's one of a kind, yeah. as are you. I'm glad there's you.
Thank you.
Another great song. Tom Adira, Jimmy Dorsey.
Man.
You recorded that.
Yeah, I love that. I love that song.
Do you still do it? With that cool turnaround?
Sure.
But I think this is going to be the last song we do today. I can't believe how quickly this hour has gone by, man. You're just you're a fabulous guest.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on this show.
Well, I'm glad there is you. Let's hear it.
All right. Thank you.
That was beautiful, Lawrence, man. Fantastic reading and a really beautiful tune.
Thank you, John.
Your creativity has always been a marvel to me. I look forward to the next 30 years.
Oh, man, I do too.
You've been listening to Piano Jazz with John Weber and his guest today, Lawrence Hobgood. This program is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio and is recorded at Hirsch Studios in New York City, with post-production in the Elaine T. Freeman Suite at ETV Radio in Columbia, South Carolina. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Duke Marcos, assistant recording engineer Andrew Shire, mastering engineer David Mitchell, production manager Grant Jackson, production assistant Laura Hunsberger. The executive producer is Kobe Hennessy. The executive in charge is Linda O'Brien. Special thanks to Anya Grundman, director and executive producer of NPR Music. We love to hear from you. Our email address is pj@scetv.org. Support for Piano Jazz comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, from the Friends of Piano Jazz, NPR member stations, and NPR. Support for NPR comes from NPR contributors, which include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.